Blue Cliff Record, Case 73. Matsu's Permutations of Assertion and Denial. The Pointer. In explaining the Dharma, there is neither explanation nor teaching. In listening to the Dharma, there is neither hearing nor attainment. Since explanation neither explains nor teaches, how can it compare to not explaining? Since listening neither hears nor attains, how can it compare to not listening? Still, no explaining and no listening still amount to something. As for all of you right here, listening to me explain here, how will you avoid this mistake? For those with the eye to pass through the barrier, as a test, I'm citing this old case. Look! And the case. A monk asked Grand Master Ma, "Please, teacher, going beyond the permutations of assertion and denial, directly point out to me the meaning of the coming from the West." Master Ma said, "Oh, I'm tired today and can't explain for you. Go ask Chisung." When the monk asked Chisung, Tsung said, "Why didn't you ask the teacher?" The monk said, "The teacher had me come here to ask you." Tsung said, "I have a headache today. I can't explain it for you. Go ask Elder Brother Hai." When the monk asked Elder Brother Hai, Pai Cheng, Hai said, "At this point, after all, I don't understand." When the monk related this to Grand Master Ma, Master Ma said, "Tsang's head is white. Hai's head is black." And the verse. "Tsang's head is white, Hai's head is black. Clear-eyed, patch-robed monks cannot understand. The cult has trampled everyone on earth to death. Lin Chi isn't yet a thief who can steal in broad daylight. Going beyond the four propositions and cutting off their 100 negations, among gods and humans, only I know." So here we meet again, the monk with his question, the monk who asks for all of us our question. And he's tried to follow the pretzel-like assertions and negations. And like Jenny yesterday pointed out, it just becomes exhausting. The mind ties itself up in knots. Maybe that's partly the point. And so he says, "So leaving all of that aside, can you just tell me, what is the point of all of this? Why are we here doing this? Why this life? Why life and death and suffering and gain and loss? All the questions that we have rolled up into this one. And just tell me straightforward, for once." And I have a question for the monk. Who is it who wants to know? So there's this one within each one of us who needs to puzzle things out, who needs to get it straight, who needs to make the map. And it's important for our survival to be able to do this. And so thinking that it has worked so well every which way, we apply it in all situations. Let's puzzle it out. Let's make the map. Then we know where we can go. We get there successfully. All is well. And preferably in English, or in the case of the monk, I suppose, Chinese, in our native language. So already putting parameters on it. This answer, I want it in a certain way. And already drifting off astray. Because it turns out that we actually speak more than one language. We've used the one so much that we've forgotten about the other. The monk already knows the other language. Each of us already knows the other language. It's just fallen into disuse. So, nothing to be attained, nothing lacking. But where is this other way of understanding? So, in the meantime, the one who speaks English insists upon an answer. I need to know. And as I was pondering this koan, I remembered a video that was online that went viral. Those of you who use social media as one of your windows into the world may remember it. And it was this clip of a fellow who had come upon a double rainbow. I think I'm remembering it right. Maybe not. My mind rearranges things pretty much at whim. But maybe it doesn't matter in this case. So he had come upon a double rainbow and was utterly struck by the beauty of it. And so he started to videotape it, or maybe a friend videotaped it of him. And you can see this sort of a grainy, not very good video of the rainbow in the background, and this fellow talking about how wonderful it is. He can't get over it. It's incredible. It's bringing him to tears. And he says, "What does it mean? What does it mean?" And then he starts crying again, and, "Oh, it's so beautiful." And this goes on for quite a while, which makes it rather funny. You know, we laugh first because, well, it's just a rainbow, you know, and a rather crappy video of one at that. And what does he expect it to mean? It's a rainbow. Tsang's head is white. Hai's head is black. What more is there to say? And the fullness of his emotion about it. The joy that it brings forth. And how curious that, I mean, so we can chuckle about this and about his asking about meaning in this matter of joyousness. But what about in matters of great sorrow? And this joy and sorrow is not so far apart. We leak water at the eyes for both of them. What a curious reaction. I think of them not as on opposite ends of a line, but on two parts of a circle that goes round and round and meets on either end. So this joy, this sorrow, we ask, what does it mean? What does it mean? And we feel the tug that there must be some way to explain this. Won't someone tell me in English? So we have this way of examining what happens around us to try to understand it. And in this examining, there's a tendency to hold it out apart from us. Here I am, and here is this rainbow. Here I am, and here is this sad thing over here that happened. As if we were looking at the world through a telescope. How can we best examine it? I know. Let's get out the telescope. We'll have a look. And there at the far end, magnified big, but so circumscribed, is this matter up for examination. And the monk is trying to do the same thing. He has his telescope out. He's trying to search out the meaning of this world, this life. And so the first person that he meets, his teacher, he goes to his teacher appropriately and asks his question. And Master Ma says, I'm tired today. I can't explain it. Susan, yesterday, in her comments so beautifully suggested that here was an opportunity to put down the telescope that separates, that creates this gap between us and our life, and to just step into it with a heart that desires to serve. How can I make it easier for you, Master Ma? Go and rest, and I'll take care of this matter. But the monk is still looking for a particular sort of answer. And so he goes on and asks Chitsung his same burning question. Tsung says, I have a headache. I can't explain it for you. Up comes the telescope. What about this headache? In fact, he looks past the headache. It must be somewhere around here. If only the headache would get out of the way. And so he misses another opportunity to put it down and step into his life, a life that has no circumscribing border, a life that goes out in every direction infinitely and includes everything. So he goes to a third person. Elder Brother Hai, and asks his burning question, telescope at the ready. And Hai says, at this point, after all, I don't understand. Ah, another confounding situation, another obstruction to the view, and another opportunity missed. And I must confess that I, too, don't understand. And so I'm hoping that David will clear this up for us.
I was touched last night by Kate's story. I love so much to go kayaking with Kate. Because although I never do it in person, when she tells these stories, I go kayaking. We go kayaking, and there we are. But there are no bugs, no dirt, just the beautiful moonlight. And it reminded me of a kayaking trip I went on in Georgian Bay, and quite a beautiful and wild place. And we were out at the full moon too, and some of us decided to go out on a night such as Kate described. And so we all went out. I think four or five of us paddled out on this still summer night. And there we were. And I was overcome with sadness because the moon was there, and indeed the problem was that it only came to my boat. I looked around and it was clear that the moon did not come to anyone else's boat except mine. Later on, when I compared notes, of course what I found is that the moonlight comes right to everyone's boat. And this moonlight is life, is your life. As Kate was so wonderfully saying just now, we go around looking for the moon, looking for our head, looking for our heart. And here in this tremendously difficult and tremendously wonderful work we do, we have the opportunity to stop. The great opportunity, partly because if we move, someone will yell at us. Our lovely tantos that seem so nice, yet we know what will happen if we wiggle too much. someone will come and take us into the parlor. Say, David, how are you doing? You're wiggling a little bit. This is their great kindness, and this is the great kindness of this form. We make this vow. And the mind runs around. The mind still says, where is it? Where is it? Where is my life? Where is my love? I'm sure it's somewhere. And this delusion of separation, I think, is the most painful delusion for us human beings. This way that we divide the world, there are two categories in the world. There is me and there is everything else. And from the ordinary mind, this is so clear. We know our own feelings and our own interiority, but we do not have that same experience of other people. And so we imagine that we are separate. And I think as we sit, we can begin to see, experience that what arises, although on one hand so deeply personal, the ancient stories, the ancient wounds, the ancient joys arise. But as we look into the true nature of their arising, we can see that it is not a thing. This arising of this moment, this sadness, this discouragement, this joy, this ease, is part of this vast coming and going that cannot be spoken of. This is the teaching that is not teaching. And this is the listening that is not listening. We as humans want to reify the world. We want to divide it up and name it, and we find great joy. And a wonderful thing, these telescopes we have. And yet this invitation that Kate and Master Ma give to us is this invitation to the dance. Let's not talk about it. Let's not read about it. Let's not study it. Let's do it. And don't we all want to be intimate with our life? Sometimes we say our practice is closing the gap between ourself and ourself. And we so often imagine that we are sitting outside, and we imagine we can tell how we're doing. Well, how's the morning going? Well, I had a good morning. Or, oh boy, I had a bad morning. Constant judgment. And again we hear, and in Okamura's reading this morning, you cannot judge your practice. So it's nice if you feel good about your practice. I'm happy for you. But if you feel terrible about your practice and yourself, I'm happy for you too. You are a human being, and your human functioning is working just right. And this human functioning, the judgment, the good, the bad, the where is it, the I don't have it, this is all the dance itself. This very body is the Buddha. This very place is the Lotus Land. And here you and I have an opportunity to put down the ancient burden, to see into the ancient burden. This ancient burden, your terrible karma, is the entry point. This makes no sense. This is the teaching that cannot be comprehended. You cannot, I cannot know how to do this. If you know how to do this, if you know where you're going, you are wrong. This is a delusive certainty. But we can enter into the wondrous uncertainty, the wondrous aliveness that is our life. This appearing and disappearing that is more precious than anything, this breath. This exhaustion. This moment is beyond measure, beyond telescopes and no telescopes, beyond assertion and denial. Beyond teaching and listening, and all of us know this. All of us in our bones know this, or you wouldn't be here. So this invitation into wherever you are, if there is the big question, this yearning in you, if there is this joy, if there is this dullness, if there is nothing, this is it. White hair, black hair, no hair. This is it. This no assertion, no denial, no certification, no dialoguing. Let's just stop talking. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. If you want to come into the aisle from behind the radiator, please do. And just a reminder that in the back, as I was talking, someone raised their hand indicating a little bit more, and one of my colleagues saw that and poked me with her elbow. So if you can't hear what someone's saying, just give the little bit more sign, and we'll try to keep the volume so we all hear. So questions or observations?
So, since Melissa and Bob introduced this case last night, I've been quite pulled into the character of the monk who travels and asks, and found him kind of fascinating. And he's an interesting character. I think he's a lot like me in a way. He's very obedient. Go ask him. Runs right in. Well, what struck me is, and what really pulled me into his character, is the end. Each time he's told something, he goes and does something. And at the end, he goes back to Master Ma and says, well, those dirty rats wouldn't tell me the answer. And Ma says, the white hair and black hair. Yeah. And then it just ends. It doesn't tell us what he does. And so it drew me right into being him. And what would I do? Toss off my robes. Screw this. go become a farmer. Or have a great awakening and become a famous Zen master. Why does it stop there? Huh. The story.
What's your sense of why it stops there?
It feels like a gift.
Right. Say more about the gift.
The gift is the invitation to that I felt to live with that connection to that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Sometimes David and I teach retreats to non-Zen people. And sometimes we'll tell Zen stories, and then, you know, the story ends, and everybody's sort of looking up,
Where's the punchline? What comes next? Well, that's it. That's how it ends. And I'm struck, David, by what you're saying, that the gift of it is that we continue the exploration because it's not neatly tied up with a ribbon for us, as so many things are. And the invitation in Zen is always, so what next? Mm. Now what? Huh? There's a lot of huh?
And David Reinick just gave us this gift. He said, let's stop talking. And then my fantasy was we would all just be silent for the whole day.
I really appreciate what you said about it being you being able to step in because it didn't end in enlightenment, right? That always feels like a barrier, like I won't be able to meet this fully because I know it's not going to end like that for me. Yeah, this is not my story.
Okay. I was thinking about your rainbow and I feel like the guys here. What's it mean? What does it mean? And it reminded me of when my mother died. I felt like that. What does it mean? What happened? What just happened here? And I would tell people what happened, and they'd all nod. And, yeah, well, how old was she, they'd say. And, you know, I'd say, well, she was 86. Oh, yeah, well, you must have been close to her, they'd say. I mean, I was, but that wasn't the point. I thought they should be as stunned and shocked as I was. And nobody was. And I felt so lost. And I guess, like the guy with his rainbow, you know, doesn't anybody get it? What happened here? Can't they see this? And at the time I was looking at the, you know, I guess, I don't know if I was looking at this koan, but somehow I guess it had come up in a Dharma talk. How do you get away from the heat when it's hot? Die of the heat, or just be hot. And when it's cold, just be cold. And I was driving down the street, and I began to have this feeling again. What happened? What happened? Where did she go? And I remembered that, and I thought, I'll just feel this. And I thought I was going to have a heart attack. And then it just... So that's how I understood your point, Kate, which I really appreciated, but... how we keep things out here. And the only way that we understand them or experience them is just to do it. Just, yeah. Thank you.
I used to, when I first started to sit, I used to come to this place, I'm sorry, louder. When I first started to sit, I used to come to this place of what I experienced as a deep well filled with tears, and it was dark. You know, and this was my subjective you know, how I felt about this place that I had reached in my zazen, and it was so terrifying that I would drown in all of these tears of sorrow, right? And I would, my heart would start to beat faster. It felt very threatening, and so I would back off. And it's that anticipation or apprehension of what it will mean to die in this sorrow that is the painful part, right? The actual dropping into it is just.
So where I go with this koan is kind of a real blending of teacher-student. Just noticing really the relationship quality. You know, people ask me about Zen, and I often don't know what to say. I want to say something inspiring. maybe the monk is showing up for his teachers, giving them something to do.
Yeah, I know, maybe about it. He is showing up for his teachers and for all of us.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me think, too, that so these roles we play, of course, are only provisional. So teacher, student, utterly dependent on each other. So there's no teacher without a student, and each one of us is a teacher. And everyone who comes with a genuine question is a gift, is a teaching. And in our meal chant we say, see the emptiness of the three worlds, giver, receiver, and gift. And I think as we talk and listen to each other, when we really get into it, it's hard to tell who's who. And this role, when we play our role as server, as Mokugyo player, there is this dance of life that no longer are we separate. We see there is no such thing as a separate human being. It is in relationship. This is Sangha here. And we each can't tell who's who. Yeah, so thank you.
Steve, did you have a hand up?
Yeah, I wanted to say something trivial, and I apologize at the beginning for saying this, but in the Western world, okay, there's this experience that we can have sometimes with art, that perhaps begins to go beyond this language that, you know, we all attempt to use. And I just remember an experience that I had where I had an opportunity to go to Italy with my wife, and I got to see the original David. This was before your time.
Who is the original? Where is he? Let me know. I've been looking for him.
Well, there's a representation of him in Florence. And I just remember, you know, you go in there, there's all this art stuff. Okay, you go in there, and you know, I was just stunned. Absolutely stunned by this thing. I mean, we've all seen pictures of it, right? But until you stand there and actually look at the real thing, it's you haven't seen the real thing. And we struggle with language. And, you know, this whole business that the monk is trying to understand, you know, and... How does teachers explain this thing? They, you know, except through the means that they have.
Right. Pointing. Right. Finger pointing at the moon.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like what you said was trivial at all, although I think it's really interesting that you started that way, because it allowed me to open to what you were going to say as a surprise, instead of, you know, wow, let me prepare for the profundity of the double rainbow here. I really am grateful to you for persisting, even with that little piece of judgment at the beginning. And I think that in these trivialities lies the whole world. You know, and one of the things that happens in that story about the double rainbow, I haven't seen that video, but I can imagine, you know, rainbow, wow, you know, and it strikes me as that koan about somebody coming in and saying, everything, me and all things are one fabric, isn't that amazing? And the teacher brings them out to the garden and points to a peony and says, people these days see this flower as though they were in a dream. And it's sort of like seeing the David itself without the even the mask of,
this is a really important piece of art. You better really.
And just one last thing about that. When recently, I guess it was a year or two ago, David and I were, this David, the non-marble version, were in Florence, and our host took us to see Michelangelo's last sculpture, which is unfinished. And it's a little bit like, you know, David Crusoe talking about the story just ends. There's a lot of raw marble around it, and it's the Pietà. It's so effing moving. we just like didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know what to do with it. I couldn't tie the bow around it. And that there's something about life that feels that way for me. When I try to get to the conclusion, I cut off all possibilities. And the unfinished quality of life. We tell I mentioned this yesterday, we tell stories. Like the monk, he told a story, you know, and this is what happened to me, you'll never believe it, this guy, that guy. And just Ma's response is, you know, he could have said to me, yeah, it's a sculpture made of marble. Right? So,
I was just going to say, hey, first of all, I was going to say, hey, it's not trivial. That, you know, I think part of it is I had that experience with the David.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, the naked David, not one of these two. And,
wait a minute.
There's an image. It's like the dawn.
Yes. But I think what, you know, we're talking about how do we, what's the value of explaining? What's the value of listening? When, you know, we know that words are so incomplete, and we're trying to point to this. And I think of Dogen's man in the boat who can only see what the eye can see, what that eye can see. And it seems to me that the artist, that art is one way of another human being saying, look at the world through these eyes. And that he somehow allowed us to, like, oh my gosh. And maybe even the man looking at the double rainbow, that it's probably not just funny, it's like, this human being is filled with joy about nature, and I may get a glimpse of that from the video.
I'd like to say one brief word about the explaining, because that's what caught my ear too.
A little bit louder.
For myself, at any rate, I don't, I hope I don't try to explain so much as, and don't feel the need to, because there's this this faith in the recognition that each person has what's already needed. So there's an encouragement to stick with it long enough to see that. Right? That's what I see as my function. Oh dear, I don't know who's next.
You pick, just
Alan.
I was really struck by, David, by your image building on Kate's lovely story last night of being out in the little boat and the moonlight coming right to your boat and kind of feeling sorry the other boats, and then finding out, oh no, everybody had that experience. So yes, we're not alone, you know, yes, we're not separate. And I think an important part of the way this story is working for me, and it's going to stay with me, is the moonlight can only come to our boat. And you know, the real problem would be if you thought it was coming to everybody else's boat, yeah, not yours. And then, you know, and that's the koan, isn't it?
Yeah.
The moonlight seems to be coming to your boat. What's the moonlight? Sorry, I got a fish on the line. What's the moonlight? I'm feeling a little seasick. Ask him.
Yeah, beautiful. Right. I love that. Thank you.
Susan?
Oh, it just struck me this morning a new way to look at this koan, because we had a reading that contained something that's in a lot of readings. It says, you know, when you're worried about this or you can't do this, well, just Zazen is the answer. Just Zazen. But I have a friend who's gotten really interested in the neuroscience of meditation, which kind of, you know, makes me back up. But she says, what's good about Zazen is it makes you not frantic to find out the answer. The monk is running around just thinking, I cannot stand it if I cannot get the answer to this right now. And just sitting still over and over and over, again and again, you do learn you can stand it. And sometimes something comes along, it may not be exactly what you thought you wanted to see, but if you sit there, some things will come to you. So that I think meditation is a really vital tool to getting through these feelings of, if I don't find this out right now, I don't know what I'll do.
Well, I think that's the kind of patience Kate was talking about, you know, and I think that's what we help each other with in those moments where we, you know, want to run screaming out of the room, that the patience and the courage and the vulnerability, because we so want it and we so don't, are so afraid, you know, this deep well of sadness, anger, anxiety, we all have our deep well of something that terrifies us. And this is the well of life, right? We find that, it isn't what I thought.
And I agree with everything you've said. And, you know, the neuroscience is really interesting, actually, whatever it means, you know. But I also want to speak up for, I should say, and I also want to speak up for that frantic running around. Because I'm thinking of another koan where somebody, you know, walk along with their teacher and says, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? And the teacher says, I'm not going to tell you. And the, or some question. You know, I think it's alive or dead. I won't say. And the, no, that's, I'm conflating two koans. Anyway, so this happens a lot, clearly. The teacher won't answer. And in this one case I'm thinking of, the student says, if you don't answer me, I'm going to hit you. And the teacher says, I can't answer you. And the student hits him. You know, that right there, there's some energy in this that also is quite valuable. So it's not one or the other. So we bring a kind of energy to the Zazen practice itself that is based on all that running around. You know, and I hope that everybody here, or at least many of us, have run around, like are tearing our hair out over this matter of life and death. What does it mean to be a human being? I don't get it. I thought, and then there's a secret practice, I thought Zen would solve all my problems. Oh, but wait a minute. And some of you may still feel that, so just put your fingers in your ears. There's not problem solving as the base of this. There's other ways you can problem solve in life, you know, engineering, science. This is not about that. This is about being willing to stay with the franticness or with the peacefulness or whatever's coming up and stay until it fades into something new and then stay with that. Thank you.
Did you have your hand up, Deb?
I did. And now what I'm going to say is even more important because Melissa just said that. I'm going to mention a Facebook story. I don't know if some of you have seen this, but it's a birthday party and they have one of these things. What do you call them? Where you hit them?
Pinata.
And this pinata is, I think it's shaped like some animal. I can't remember the animal. And they give this little boy the stick. And he goes up to hit it and he just stops and puts his arms around it. And it's just such an encounter, you know, it's such an encounter, it's such a moment of seeing things in a completely different way. And I just cannot look at a piñata now.
Well, and I love that, you know, we have this plan and we've been told we've got to hit it with a stick, we've got to do this, and this possibility, this wild possibility that our heart longs for and also knows is true, that we might embrace our life instead of trying to get through the terrible problem that is me. So what a lovely image, and Deb, as you say it, I feel your heart embracing life. This is...
It could have been David.
I'm sure it was.
Boy,
doesn't matter.
It was like he just couldn't hurt it.
Yeah.
Well, it occurs to me, too, that this is another way of talking about what I was just talking about. And these are all different ways of pointing, different words, embracing, staying, hating, but, you know, and, you know, it's the heat and cold thing that Kate was bringing up. And there's also a time to, I'm going to use the word desist. there's also a time to say, I cannot take this anymore. I don't mean it in the same way. We had a private conversation. There's a time to find our resources and rest. Mm. And one of the ways I think the brilliance of the way Sasheen is organized is that it's not just sitting in zazen from 4 in the morning till midnight. You know, there's entertainment.
Voila!
As long as it's not a naked David.
but there's periods of rest. We don't call them breaks. They're periods of rest practice. So there's getting in there and really embracing with that great love or interest or fear or whatever is coming up, the staying. And then there's the you got to breathe in and breathe out. So this is our practice. It's designed this way, in a way. And I really appreciate it for myself. And I hope some of you are getting or have gotten that taste as well. And it's so touching.
I just want to give a mention to the fourth character, the elder monk. Probably got identified with. Sorry. I didn't know this was here. I appreciated the simplicity and the honesty of his answer. Just, I don't know. And his character, that being the elder monk, he still stays. And not out of, you know, I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. It's just, I don't know. And just kind of living that. And that's all I needed to say.
Well, and we can get so caught in this sort of bifurcation. It is a Sangha koan. It is the wisdom of the Sangha. Each person showing up as themselves, and this this monk who doesn't stand up in front and give a big Dharma talk like some people I know. The David, right? Yeah. He just open-heartedly meets another human being points the way with his whole heart.
And you know that just from what we know about that guy, he was not yet a Zen teacher or master. He was just a sincere practicing monk. And he is Baijan, the famous Baijan who established monastic rule and met the fox. And you know, but this was before all that. And if you actually think about him, as he persisted in his life and ended up getting thrown out of that Master Maz monastery to do his own thing. Mm-hmm. He's heroic to me in a lot of ways. I love that first encounter that he has with the fox, where he just says, "Who are you?" Like that persistence of not knowing characterizes his teaching. And he's not like Master Ma. He doesn't beat people up and yell and shout. He's always really curious. You know, let's see what's going on. And I think there's some way that we persist through time as the valuable one who is just starting out, and then the old one who's still like that young guy. And then, you know, whatever role we end up being foisted on us. Yeah, like cheeky.
And I just want to point out the poignancy of what you said, because from one old monk to another, like to really be at this point in our lives and to say, no, I've never been enough. I've never been enough. Mm-hmm. That is a profound admission of what's real. Mm-hmm. But oh my God, really? That fantasy of finally getting to that place is never going to come true? Never. And so I just want to bow to you for showing it and naming it.
So delete it.
Did you have a hand? Yeah. Yes.
Sorry, I got lost. The story for me, currently in the world, it's a crazy place to be when you're African American or from another place. And I remember the very first time I was called an N-word, I was 16. And we had moved to a new neighborhood in New Jersey. And I got through that year. It all ended. And then it just seems like I wasn't called that for a really long time. And now it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, people have license to say and do whatever they want to say and do. So in the beginning, I asked why. Like, what's going on? What happened? What changed? Why? I thought people were different. I thought, what happened? You know? And then I realized that it just was quiet, and now it's surfacing, and that all I can do is be me. You know? And either you accept me as I am, or I have to realize that that doesn't have anything to do with me. I have to protect myself, I have to put my ducks in order, but I don't have to, I don't have to find the answers. I'm not going to find the answers. I wish they would go away tomorrow, but they're not going away tomorrow. How long they last, I hope it's over in my lifetime, in my children's lifetime, maybe it won't be. But I think I've learned through all this that I can ask that question over and over again. And I can watch my son's being racially profiled, and I can hear about kids in the neighborhood, and I can do that over and over again, and all that does is stress me to the point that I'm no longer healthy, and I can't be the best me that I can be. But it's really, really difficult just being sometimes.
Yes.
And so sometimes sitting at least takes the edge off of the best being.
Well, I love that it just takes the edge off. Because what you're pointing to is human nature is not maybe going to change, even though we all have the secret wish that it will. And how can we cope with it? And sometimes we just get exposed. People do awful, cruel things. And then we have to, that goes back to what I was saying before about you have to breathe in and breathe out. We have to have that moment for the in-breath, some place of refuge. And Zazen is that for me, for sure. Not always. Sometimes my mind goes nuts and I can have these battles right here on the cushion. But yeah, just to emphasize again and again that we can't fix the world and we can't fix ourselves. But we can keep asking, what is this? What is this? And then when it gets too much, again and again and again. Thank you for naming that. It's very important.
And I think, too, you point to not living in la-la land.
Right.
You know, some of us can fall into that in certain situations, and some have no choice, but our practice is to nurture ourselves, to do this, and then to act skillfully in the world, right? So how there are times when I need to protect myself, and this is not because my Zen practice is not strong enough. This is because I'm seeing what's going on. So an invitation to all of us to breathe in, as Melissa said, to nourish ourselves, and then to look at this world and do what we're called to do, to protect ourselves and to protect other people. We are called to live in the world and to meet it not in a theoretical way. So I really appreciate you calling that forward. Like, all right, there are very hateful and painful things going on. And our job is not to say, oh, it's all fine, because it's not. And so then how do we live skillfully as we walk this path? So, thank you. And I think with that, we'll really stop talking.